on KPTZ right now, so we might have had a much larger audience for that last bit of that discussion about mental illness awareness week in our community. And so we're joined now by Dr. Barry and
let's see Willie.
I see Willie had a question this week, and there he is. So yeah. Good morning, Dr. Barry.
Good morning, everyone. Glad to listen in for the last part of that presentation. I think it's a really critical issue that's been facing our area since before the pandemic and certainly exacerbated by some of the challenges related to the pandemic. So I'm glad we're talking about it openly. So moving into the COVID-19 update, on the COVID-19 front, the story is a bit mixed nationally at this point. Nationwide, case rates are continuing to downtrend, down 25% in the last week, with hospitalizations down 12% and deaths down 10%, but still seeing just over 400 people dying a day in the United States as a whole. However, we're starting to see case rates increasing in the Northeast and the West Coast, including Washington State. In Washington State, case rates are up 11%. Hospitalizations are actually up 9%. Deaths are relatively flat at this point. We think the primary driver of the hospitalization rise is there are several large long-term care facility outbreaks on the east side of the state where vaccination is less common, even in elders. And so that's driving a lot of severe disease in that population, which does affect the state as a whole because we all share one hospital system. So that's affecting the situation here. In Jefferson County, we have diagnosed 5,961 cases of COVID-19. Our case rate is up to 460 per 100,000. Our percent positivity is up as well to 11%, with approximately a 40% case ascertainment rate at this time. We have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19 for a total of 152 hospitalizations in this response, and no new deaths to report for a total of 31 deaths in this response. The primary driver of our rise in cases in recent weeks has been school-related transmission. We have several small outbreaks in schools. We're working very closely with the schools to mitigate those, but that is certainly a driver of transmission at this point. We do strongly recommend masking in school settings. It's not mandatory unless it is in a space where we have had a cluster of COVID-19 cases. In those cases, it does become mandatory. In Clallam County, we've diagnosed 15,577 cases of COVID-19. Our case rate is 153 per 100,000 in Clallam County with a percent positivity of 7.5 and roughly a 50% case ascertainment rate. We also have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19 in Clallam for a total of 442 hospitalizations and no new deaths to report for a total of 124. So what we are starting to see is a rise in cases, but so far, thankfully, not a rise in severe disease. We're not seeing a rise in hospitalization or death in either of our counties. And we think the primary driver for that is how well vaccinated our counties are. So the vaccines are still doing a great job at preventing severe disease and death. And we're very hopeful that the Omicron-specific booster will actually prevent transmission itself, but it's relatively new on the scene, and not everyone has had a chance to get it yet. Unfortunately, nationally and in other parts of our state, there's a lot less vaccination. And so we are seeing a rise in severe disease related to the move into the fall and winter. So that really just goes to show that COVID-19 is still a significant severe disease. If you are not up to date on your vaccine, so please do get up to date on your vaccines if you haven't already. That includes getting the Omicron specific booster if you are eligible. And a reminder that everyone 12 and up who's had their last vaccine or infection 2 months ago or more is eligible for the Omicron specific booster. And we do have enough in town now, so you don't have to wait if you're worried that you are that you're not in one of those severe groups. You are eligible now. A lot of our pharmacies are vaccinating very effectively, including and especially Tri-Area Pharmacy is really doing a lot. Safeway in Port Townsend is doing a lot as well. And I also want to acknowledge our partners at Jefferson Healthcare are working really hard to vaccinate their patients as well. And of course, our public health and DEM volunteers who are working very hard at our mass vaccination clinics every weekend this month to make sure that our highest risk individuals are vaccinated. On the MPV front, we still have no documented cases in Jefferson County. We have one confirmed and two suspect cases in Clallam County diagnosed. 581 cases have been diagnosed in Washington as a whole and over 25,000 nationally. We do have adequate supply of the Jynneos vaccine. So if you're interested in that vaccine, which includes anyone who's gay or bisexual or men who have sex with men, particularly gay men or bisexual men are eligible for that. Anyone who has had an STI in the last year or who has had multiple partners in the last year is eligible for that vaccine. A good reminder that for many folks who are dating right now, multiple partners is pretty common over the course of a year. And so it doesn't take a lot to get eligible for the Jynneos vaccine. So if you're interested in that, give us a call at the health department and we'll go ahead and get you vaccinated. So with that, I am happy to take any questions from our commissioner.
Any questions for Dr. Berry?
I have a couple questions, but a lot of them are addressed in the KPTZ questions. So maybe I'd wait until after those questions.
Nothing for me.
Sounds good.
The only thing I was wondering when we need to start coordinating on this is kind of the end of the emergency declaration and the end of the mm-hmm. month and changing your, if we're going to change your the schedule of your updates, we probably should start planning for that. Maybe you guys already are in other forums and I'm just not sitting at those tables. So,
sure. Yeah. So there are big changes coming with the end of the emergency declaration. One of the biggest is around funding. So funding for all of our activities around COVID is really dramatically decreasing after the end of that that declaration, and that affects the work that we're able to do as a department. One of the things that changes around that is actually my hours that are budgeted for by the county. So I go down to 12 hours a week for the county. One of the things that we talked about in that was potentially changing the cadence of this update. I think it is still really important to keep public health front and center and acknowledge that COVID is not over and we're still here and there's still lots of questions in the community. But potentially going to a monthly cadence might make a little more sense as we move out of the emergency declaration. So one of the things we've been talking about a bit is after October 31st, moving to once a month, having a public health presence at this meeting. So folks could still tune in and follow along and have their questions answered.
Just think of all the airtime that's going to free up for Bob Marley.
Well, I mean, that raises the question, do we want to try to fill that space with other updates?
Right. Yeah. So I think I just wanted to get the topic on the table because it's the beginning of October and we have a few more meetings where we can talk about this. But, I know that a vast number of people in our community are going to miss these weekly updates. And my mom being one of them, she's probably listening right now. But I'm actually have never been a commissioner without these weekly updates. So I don't really know how to navigate this transition best. But I just want to say that I really appreciate the consistency and regular cadence that we have had you guys with us and addressing all the questions that come up in our community. And I know that we've come to rely on you probably inordinately so. But I just want to start having the conversation so that we're not pulling the Band-Aid off.
I think it's good to prep for. Mm-hmm. And I think my recommendation would be to keep some kind of steady presence, but maybe just not as frequently. I think there will always be public health issues to talk about. We'll have COVID, but there are other things that we're always working on that we could answer questions about too. So I find when we've had to scale back other meetings and we've gone to every 2 weeks, that gets very confusing. But monthly is something people can track so they can plan to tune in for that.
Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, that was my only topic for today. So I guess we can turn to the list of KPTZ questions. I know there were a few for you, Dr. Berry, and one for Willie.
So one was about kind of timing of the bivalent or the Omicron specific booster. So this person said for two healthy individuals aged 67 and 75, when should they get their booster? And so if you're healthy, you don't have underlying conditions, you're not immunosuppressed or undergoing cancer therapy, you're going to get your best bang for your buck if you wait 4 months, actually. So minimum 2 months, but 4 months since your last vaccine or infection. So if you got a booster a couple months ago, or you unfortunately got COVID a couple months ago, if you wait 4 months since then, you're going to get your best immune response to your vaccine. So that's what I generally recommend for folks, unless you're in a very high risk group. This person also referenced that they were going to be traveling in February, so planning vaccination around there. So if you, for instance, have a major trip where you know you're going to get a lot of exposure, getting vaccinated, if it's been more than 2 months, about 2 weeks before that trip will get you your most benefit prior to that trip. So just a couple of things to weigh, but generally 4 months since your last infection or booster is going to be the best bet unless you're very high risk. If you're very high risk, say you're undergoing chemotherapy, we just want to get you as much protection as soon as we can. So in that case, 2 months since your last infection or booster is going to be the way to go. This person also asked about, they are traveling to a place where Paxlovid isn't available, and they were wondering what to do about that. Is that something that they can get to bring with them? You know, around travel, a lot of folks might bring antibiotics or bring something in case they get sick out of country, and this person's traveling out of country. Unfortunately, Paxlovid is not one of those things that we can get and keep in advance of needing it. There's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that it's entirely federally funded. So it's something that's paid for by the federal government. And so there's very strict ways that we prescribe it. And so if a doctor prescribes it outside of those spaces, we can get in trouble and end up not being able to receive more Paxlovid. So unfortunately, it's not something we can give for travel. We really can only give it for folks who are positive. However, this person did acknowledge that they don't have underlying conditions and they are up to date on their vaccines and planning to get their Omicron-specific booster. So in that case, I think you'll actually do okay even without Paxlovid. In the unlikely chance that you come down with COVID and you're out of country, if you're up to date on your vaccines, it won't be fun to have COVID, but you are very unlikely to have severe disease if you're really up to date. So the best thing to do, make sure you're up to date on your vaccines and wear a high quality mask in high risk spaces. So on the plane, on any kind of bus, any kind of indoor gathering space. And then this person said they were traveling to Mexico. If you're going out to eat, going to someplace that has, you know, open windows, open doors, outdoor seating is going to really reduce the risk of you contracting COVID while you're there. If you take all those precautions, I think you can have a really good trip. Another person was just kind of checking in about autoimmune disease and COVID. I'm really glad that our answer was helpful to you and hope you can stay healthy through this fall and winter. I want to encourage everyone to get their flu vaccine as well. The flu season has not gotten into full swing yet, but we anticipate that it will in the coming months. So one of the biggest ways you can protect yourself is getting your flu vaccine as well. This next person had a question about rapid antigen tests and reports they're seeing that people are testing positive longer with rapid antigen tests with Omicron variant than they were with prior variants. It's not really clear for sure that people are testing positive longer with Omicron, rather that we have much more widespread availability of testing. And so we didn't used to have tests in our home where we could test daily and see when we stopped testing positive. And so it's possible that folks were testing positive longer even before, but we just didn't have that kind of data available to us. But this person was wondering, you know, what do they do with that information? If you're testing positive past day 10, does that mean you should stay in isolation? What does it mean for higher risk family members, things like that? I would say generally, we still aren't recommending using antigen tests to decide when to end isolation. But if you have a very high risk family member you're worried about being around and you have access to the antigen test to support that and you're realizing you're testing positive at day 10, what I would recommend is avoiding those highest risk spaces. So say you have a family member you want to visit in long-term care and you're still testing positive on antigen tests, that would be one space where I think it would make sense to go ahead and wait until you're testing negative before you enter that space. If you're not wanting to burn through antigen tests, you could test every other day as opposed to every day to wait until you test negative. It's not clear that folks after day 10 are actually staying contagious. We do see that that viral load really drops over the course of your infection. And one of the biggest things that you can do to reduce your risk of transmitting infections to others is to wear a mask. So if you're going to be going out and about and you know you're still testing positive, wearing a mask in those spaces makes a huge difference. So it's really all about the risk of where you're going, the risk of the folks that you're around, and if all of these things are accessible to you. We're not recommending that the general public test every day to figure out when to leave isolation because there is so much COVID in our community. Things like strict isolation and quarantine really made a lot more of a difference back when there was less COVID going around. But if you have someone who's very high risk and it would be really, really dangerous for them to get COVID, steering clear of that person or that space until you are testing negative is a good idea. The other thing to know is that while they are not technically approved as quantitative tests, there is some degree of quantitative measure there. So you may see if you've been testing yourself and you have COVID that the line gets darker and turns positive faster at certain points in your illness. That correlates with higher viral load. And so if at the end you're starting to see like a faint line, you're not even sure if it's positive, you can feel confident that you're dealing with a lower viral load at that point, which is less likely to transmit to others, and certainly less likely if you're wearing a mask in those kinds of settings.
Can I follow up on that, Dr.? Yeah, please, feel free. So this is the one that I'm a little interested in. You know, it's just when we started out, you know, as you kind of said, it was a very kind of binary thought process to get through once you've been infected with COVID. How do I, you know, re-engage with the world? It's gotten a lot grayer, at least to me. So I just kind of want to reiterate. So 5 days after a positive test, if your symptoms are abating, you stop isolation. And whether
you can leave isolation, but you do need to wear a mask for the next 5 days.
Right. Okay. And after 10 days, you're done. And positive antigen tests don't really matter for that 5 day threshold or the 10 day threshold.
So the thing to know about the threshold, so with COVID, we do actually think you stay positive for closer to 10 days. The move from 10 to 5 days wasn't really based on the fact that you're no longer contagious. It's that you're less contagious after day five. And so that's why masking after day five is so critical, because 80% of people are still contagious on day six. But if you add the mask on top of that, then you dramatically reduce the risk that you can give it to other folks. And so it was a way to get people back into the world, get them back in their lives while minimizing risk. It doesn't make it zero risk, but it minimizes it. What really happens to your infectiousness is it follows a curve. And so it peaks up in those first few days and then falls progressively over the next 7 to 10, depending on when you hit that peak. And so you're getting less and less contagious each day after that. And so that's why we start allowing folks to leave isolation, is if you're less dangerous. You're not zero risk of giving it to others, but less risk. And so we do think that if you stay masked after day five and you're really thoughtful about that masking, not taking it off to eat with others, things like that, that you are low risk of transmitting to others. But if you have someone where they got COVID, they're going to die in your family, I would steer clear of them until you're really past 10 days for sure. And if you have access to antigen tests to double check before you see them, that's a good option too.
Great. That's helpful. And then if you're immunocompromised though, and you get a positive, then the isolation is 20 days, at least some
20
people.
20 days, yeah.
And that's because even if you're getting a negative antigen test, because of your immunocompromised system, you are more likely to transmit it to others. Is that correct?
Great question. So the 20 days is built off of really just sampling overall of immunosuppressed people. So people who are immunosuppressed are more likely to shed live virus longer. However, that would be one space where you could use a antigen test to potentially shorten your isolation. So say after 10 days, you're testing negative, I think it would be reasonable to leave isolation sooner than 20 days if you're testing negative at that point. We don't think you're going to have a false negative on those tests. You're going to have a lower viral load if you're really testing negative, and that'd be a way to get out a little sooner than 20 days, because 20 days is incredibly hard for most folks to reach.
Yeah, great.
Great question.
Can I just dig a little deeper here?
Sure.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Dr. Berry, but just curious, like, would you say, I mean, would you recommend that if people can do the full 10 days that they do, but that if there is a compelling need to come out of isolation after five, that you can mitigate that risk. But you know, that 80% at day six, that's still pretty darn contagious. And I know at day six, I was still had a lot of fluids and, you know, there was still contagion possibility for sure. So
it's definitely safer to stay out till day 10. And I think that's one of the places where I think communication from federal levels down has been very confusing. And I've seen it also get kind of contorted when it gets moved into policy. So I saw that there was an organization that was saying you had to come back on day six and that you won't get sick time after day five. And that's not what we want to see. The best is to stay out until day 10. You have to stay out until day five. If you can accommodate staying out till day 10, that's always going to be safer.
Thank you.
No worries. And if you're going to come back after day five, you really should be feeling better. If you're feeling very sick still, you can count on the fact that you're still shedding virus that could infect the people around you. So you really want to stay home until you're better. And as a family physician, I want to advocate for it's important for anyone who's sick to be able to stay home when they're sick. I really want us to work on building a society that can accommodate people resting when they're ill. They're going to get better if they're not having to work through their illness, and they're going to be less likely to give it to other people who will then, you're going to have absenteeism if you encourage people to come back sick, because it's just going to get everybody else sick. It's a rapid solution to a long-term problem. And that's actually all my questions. I didn't have that many today, so I will pass to Willie.
Thank you. Another successful clinic this past weekend at Blue Heron in Port Townsend. Just a little bit shy of 400 people with either their Pfizer or Moderna booster shot at that event. This weekend, we are down in South County, down in Quilcene, offering additional booster doses there. There are still spots available in that clinic. However, that clinic is specifically for folks who either live or work or are in South County and would have to otherwise drive a little bit to go receive their booster elsewhere. So we are specifically looking for folks within the South County community at that clinic. Spots are still available. You can sign up on the public health website or give us a call here at the EOC. And we're looking forward to seeing folks out there. My KPTZ question this week came from some folks who had signed up for our clinic but opted to cancel their appointments, head to the pharmacy so they could both get their Omicron-specific booster as well as their flu shot all at the same time, kill two birds with one stone there, and ask us if we would consider adding the flu shot to our COVID vaccine booster clinics. I think that's a marvelous idea. The individual noted that would help increase flu shot uptake as well, as we are concerned about the potential flu season over the course of the winter. However, just given the fact that we only have the single clinic down in Quilcene currently scheduled, we are exploring a couple more through the end of the month that we haven't announced yet, but we'll have that information up shortly. We probably aren't going to add that for our last few clinics, especially as we're waiting for if and when the Omicron specific booster is approved for 5 to 12-year-olds. So we're going to have to add that potentially to our last remaining clinics. And so just to keep things simple, to stick with what's been working for us, we probably won't be adding the flu shot to our last couple of clinics. We are demobilizing these clinics at the end of October, as Dr. Berry mentioned, with the emergency declaration running out. We're losing access to the funding that was affording us the ability to run these clinics. So the end of October will bring the end of these mass vaccination clinics. And again, we probably aren't going to make that change and add flu shots in the interim there. So we would love to keep these going, but again, with the pharmacies taking such a bulk of the work and doing a great job, with Jefferson Healthcare stepping up, and most importantly, with our funding running out, we'll announce our last couple of clinics and then finally sunset the service that we've been providing over the past year and a half plus. So barring any questions, that's the end of my report. Other than a thank you to all the volunteers who've been supporting this activity over the last little while, and thanks to the community for their support.
I think I'm going to need counseling. for this shift. it's really quite shocking to me, actually. So bear with me, colleagues.
Yeah. To not have Dr. Barry and Willie at our fingertips every Monday morning.
Yeah. I started to feel little tears coming in the corners of my eyes. So super. I just can't say how appreciative I am of your consistency and stability and leadership and insight into this unfolding story that we've all been living through the last couple of years. And as I said earlier, haven't been a commissioner without COVID. So it's going to be we're not without it, but you know, just feels like a big shift to me. So I'm sure other people in the community are going to have some stress around this as we transition. So we're all here for each other. I'm just saying it out loud on air this morning. And we need to stay together as a community and keep taking care of ourselves and each other. And super grateful for the volunteers who've been leading the charge on these clinics and on all of our staff at Public Health. I mean, I'm overflowing with gratitude right now. So thank you. Any other last questions for Willie or Dr. Barry this morning?
I have a crystal ball question as we go into a new era of COVID response, with the end of the emergency in, federal funding drying up and everything. Obviously, we've been using that, and I'm sure lots of other jurisdictions have really been counting on those funds as well. I mean, we're still at over 400 per 100,000, in Jefferson County, and over 400 fatalities per year. I mean, what do you see through the flu season with less support to the existing mitigations that we have?
Yeah, it is concerning. I think, unfortunately, it does kind of follow a pattern that we've been doing as a country, that we get real close to getting over the finish line, and then we pull back a little too soon. And I think that may be playing out a bit at this point. One thing I am hopeful for our region specifically, I can't speak to the rest of the country, is that we are very well protected against the worst outcomes that we experience. The amount of us who are vaccinated, I think, really will reduce the likelihood that we could see an overwhelming of our healthcare system or a shutting down of critical infrastructure. I'm not actually very concerned about those happening here because we're very well protected. I think we could see that shake out in other parts of the state and the country because so many folks just haven't been able to get vaccinated because of all of the political milieu and the misinformation around that. But I think here that's unlikely to happen. So I think it's appropriate to transition to a different way of responding. But yes, I think the things that we used to mitigate transmission generally are going to be a lot harder to do and frankly impossible to do. The free COVID tests, for example, those are likely to go away by January, would be my guess, based on just looking at the funding breakdown at the state level. And so some of the ways we've really tried to mitigate transmission are gonna fade. And what I'm probably most worried about is there have been some good things we've been able to do in the pandemic. We've been able to change the way we deliver services. We've been able to make sure that people who don't have the funds to pay for healthcare can get it. We've been able to make sure that people have the funds to stay home when they're sick. Things we were able to really change societally, and a lot of the funding for that is going away or has already gone away. We've talked a bit on this program before about things like the child tax credit, which actually is largely responsible for reducing some of the severe outcomes related to the pandemic, and that went away. And so I worry about that. And I hope that we as a group and as a society can try to make sure that we carry forward the parts of this that were good, taking care of our neighbors, taking care of the most vulnerable, and don't just give up on that in the name of normalcy.
I mean, you called out free tests, and that's been huge in my own practice since they've been available, and we bemoaned the lack of them until we had them. And now it seems really short-sighted to let it disappear again. And I'm wondering if there's local prioritizations that we should consider before that happens.
Maybe worth talking about. From our end, knowing that we don't control the funding streams, we just manage out what happens once they come to us. We've been prioritizing our highest risk spaces for those tests so that we would plan to pay for tests for long-term care, for shelters, for things like that. But right now, the distributed tests that we send are from the state. And so we think that will that funding from the state will likely go away. But it'd be something to talk about some more, figure out where do we want to prioritize that work? Where do we want to prioritize those funds for our community so that our highest risk folks can still stay safe?
Thank you.
Well, and I think too, I feel lucky to have, been able to be relatively close to your brain, Dr. Berry and Dr. Locke before you, and really learned about the risk management involved in managing a pandemic. And it's something I hope the public will continue to learn about. It's so easy to think, oh, we don't have to worry about COVID anymore, or we have to worry about COVID. And those are the two options. And it's like, no, this is actually like creating a new way of thinking about how we operate in the world based on risk. And I just think that's so valuable. And maybe in one of our last calls before we lose you every week, we could talk a little bit more about that thinking and how we do that risk assessment and managing our behavior based on risk, not thinking, oh, it's either, all masks and vaccine mandates, or it's nothing. And it's like, no, there's a whole lot in between that can manage that risk for folks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a light switch, but requires a shift in our thinking as a society as a whole. And yeah, I'd be happy to dig into that some more in our next couple of weeks.
Thank you. Well, thanks you guys for being with us again this morning. While we still have the airwaves for a couple minutes, this is the day that we're gonna talk about the vacancies on the boards and committees that we oversee here. And there are a number. So if anybody who's listening on KBDZ or on Zoom, I see our Zoom attendee list has got a good number on it right now. There are Parks and Rec Advisory Board vacancies. There are ways to be involved in your community that you couldn't even have imagined. And we would love to have your service. So reach out to us in the commissioner's office if you want a list, or they're on our website, the county website, the vacancies. Anyway, just wanted to make a PSA for that while I had more ears this morning, because our chambers are empty and we will be talking about this later on our agenda this afternoon. Thank you guys. We'll give some time back to the airwaves, and grateful for our KPTZ partners and friends and neighbors. Thank you for being here with us. And we'll see.